It's Friday, December 28th. You're listening to Ozarks at Large. I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Katie Henriksen.
And I'm Timothy Dennis.
I want to say something here at the beginning. This is the last show this week that we're doing where we're talking about some of our favorite shows. In the old days, in the 60s and 70s, when they had game shows on television, there's a point to this.
Usually, yes.
They would tape all the shows. So if it was Match Game, they'd tape all the shows for a week in one day. But they'd take breaks in between catering, and oftentimes there would be booze.
Imbibing. What?
And so that's why you'd see by the Friday show of Hollywood Squares or something, sometimes they were just like really kind of goofy. Uh-huh. That's not what we're doing here.
I feel like I got dipped. I didn't know this was
not
an
what
option.
We're doing here.
Well, maybe the listeners would disagree.
At least you don't know.
You sound loopier. Yes,
I'm just saying, we're not doing that here.
That's a shame.
Some more of our favorite stories to talk about today. I'm going to start with one that I did late in the summer, early fall. A group of folks in Fort Smith are putting together the Museum of the Hardwood Tree. And it's really about how the tree and wood has meant so much to the state of Arkansas. The manufacturing, from baseball bats to furniture. Fort Smith at one time was the furniture capital of the United States. More furniture was made there than anywhere else. That was a while ago. But anyway, I talked to some of these guys and they had some great stories. Arkansas does a pretty good job of cataloging its history. Travel throughout the state and you can find museums devoted to the earliest settlements of Arkansas, the blues, aircraft, country doctors, wine, railroads, diamonds, and local history. You could make a case, though, that the most important raw material in the development of Arkansas has yet to have its own museum. But the organizers of the Museum of the Hardwood Tree are working to remedy that omission. Bob Worley says he long knew the importance that lumber and the hardwood tree played in 19th and 20th century Arkansas, but it wasn't until he was in Japan and visited a silk museum there that he had the idea to devote a museum to the hardwood tree.
And when I walked in, there was a mulberry tree and a web and a worm, and from there on to $20,000 silk kimonos. So I turned to my wife and said, if Japan can build a nice museum around a worm, we should be able to build a nice museum around the hardwood tree.
Bob returned to Fort Smith and enlisted friends and acquaintances and formed a 501c3 nonprofit. He asked his friend, an architect and fellow Rotarian, James Reddick, to help. Mr. Reddick agreed, thinking he would be primarily on board for his architectural experience, but then found out he has deep ties to the lumber industry, like so many other people. His grandfather had worked for a wagon factory in the Fort Smith area.
I remember him telling me stories about their quality control was whatever kind of wagon they built, when they constructed it, they filled it with water. If it didn't hold water, then they took it apart. It didn't pass quality control. So I believe my dad's father worked for one of the furniture factories as a boiler operator. Or an engineer.
As Bob Worley began gathering information about industries connected to the hardwood tree, he found much more than he expected. Factories devoted to building tools, wagons, and furniture from the late 19th century to the height of Fort Smith's furniture-making days in the middle of the last century. Another of Bob's friends, Eldon Pence, began helping catalog material, physical examples, and intellectual material, too. He says many of the iconic figures that helped make Fort Smith a capital of furniture manufacturing are still alive.
We have been able to interview a lot of these individuals who were so prominent in the industry and record their story of how they started and how their businesses developed and how they got intertwined and just recorded, and then it develops into a written history of what they have to offer. So we regard that as a gem, so to speak, in our efforts to record our history.
The long-term plan includes a museum in a forest setting near the Janet Huckabee River Valley Nature Center. That goal has the endorsement of several entities, including the Nature Center, the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission, and the University of Arkansas Fort Smith History Department. Earliest phases of the dream include gathering the artifacts and information needed to tell the story. Special museum software and a donated office have helped the museum organizers begin that process, and the building site has been acquired as well. Kelly Mulvihill, Nature Center Manager at the Janet Huckabee Center, says the partnership makes sense.
We interpret the general geography and animals and plants in our region, and so this goes right along with the hardwood tree.
The Nature Center has a 12-acre lake stocked with fish and 170 acres with trails that meander through different ecosystems.
Lots of hardwood trees. We've got some Oak Savanna areas, we're trying to get back to Oak Savanna. We've got pine forest that Fort Chaffee planted for us. But yeah, it used to be Fort Chaffee at one time and was turned over. But we interpret the river valley, the natural resources and natural history and what Game and Fish does in this area.
Museum organizers admit the actual museum building is likely years away. Other projects, including the planned U.S. Marshals Museum in Fort Smith, have the attention of many others right now. But Eldon Penn says the great thing about a museum dedicated to hardwood trees is that, in actuality, it already kind of exists.
But the important thing about the Museum of the Hardwood Tree is that it's right out there already. We have the museum. It's a museum at this point in time without walls, without bricks and mortar. And in cooperation with the Janet Huckabee Nature Center, which we have property that is contiguous with it, we plan on using that and hoping that they will use us as a dual educational facility and a dual attraction for not only the young and the students, but also the older people and tourists that come to town, because it is something that's different. But we're not, at this point in time, slowed down by the fact we don't have bricks and mortar.
He quickly adds that doesn't mean the museum board cannot accept tax-deductible donations or memorials. In the interim, organizers are developing ways they can work with the Nature Center, helping with tree identification on the land, assisting with trail building, and possibly creating a public demonstration of removing a dead tree with mule teams, as it might have been done more than a century ago. Certainly, there's no lack of history that can be told. Just a cursory investigation into the role of the hardwood tree in the region includes names like J.W. Fulbright, Edward Durell Stone, and Judge Isaac Parker. Railroads that expanded the country westward relied on many railroad ties manufactured here. And at one time, Arkansas had more than 1,000 secondary wood processing firms. James Reddick says the museum's board and organizers really want the anecdotes that will help eventually fill the museum.
We've got a number of photographs and documents. We've got a few artifacts. But what we'd really like to have is more stories. And the stories about people and how they related to businesses and how it all worked economically. One that Bob found recently I thought was really neat was how the people in the rural areas brought wood, how they cut wood and brought it to Fort Smith to sell every day. And on the weekends, there would be so many people coming into town that the wagons would stack up like a half a mile deep. Well, that tells me that they weren't coming from South Sebastian County. They were probably coming from Crawford County and backing up at a ferry somewhere.
There was so much commerce on some of those Saturdays that banks in Fort Smith would have to wire banks in Fayetteville to help replenish the tills by Saturday night. But the museum will not be sharing stories just from Fort Smith. Bob Worley says there were wood-related firms all over. Baseball bats were made in Harrison, for example, and then there was the Ben Pearson plant in Pine Bluff.
Bow and arrow plant in Pine Bluff that employed over 1,200 people, and they were the world's largest producer of bows and arrows for, I think, about three decades. Singer Sewing Machine Company in Truman, Arkansas. Thousands and thousands of cabinets for the sewing machines. And, of course, Harrison, you mentioned Harrison, Arkansas. Baseball bats, which is a little unusual. Not too much ash, we thought, in North Arkansas, but we find out now there was a lot of it.
Organizers say they also want to discuss management of trees and forests, that the environmental aspect is an equally compelling part of the story. But the human stories are the ones that will likely capture the attention of many people interested. And Bob Worley says those kinds of stories keep turning up. One of his favorites involves the J.A. Hopkins family, a prominent part of the Van Buren community. That family owned and operated a sawmill and plant in nearby Davidson, Arkansas, that manufactured hardwood flooring, plow handles, and occasionally one other item.
If anyone died in the community, why, they would blow the whistle at the mill, and they would all come in the middle of the night and build a walnut casket or box to bury the people in.
He says those kinds of communities were all over the state, and he hopes that the eventual Hardwood Tree Museum can share that history. You can find out more information at hardwoodtreemuseum.org or at the museum's Facebook page. This is Ozarks at Large, talking about some of our favorite stories on this final day of the week, a Friday. Antoinette.
Yes.
We mentioned earlier this week that occasionally we do something we call a field trip.
Yes.
We'll go out together, and it's not anything that's, like, timely.
Right.
It's not because we're doing it because it's
We're exploring our area.
And it's a little bit indulgent because you get to find out about a place that you might have been interested about. And hopefully listeners are interested
as well. That's the idea.
We went to Evergreen Cemetery this year, just a few blocks from here.
It's not far from here, and I really didn't know much about it at all. But you, had he asked you about this before? Is that what it was?
No, we're talking about Bill Flanagan, who kind of takes care of the cemetery. He and I ran into him at a grocery store.
That's right.
And as I'm wont to do, I start talking.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever want to get in and out of the grocery store fast and you see me,
don't
turn on your heel.
To Kyle.
Just because. And we started talking about Evergreen Cemetery for some reason. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, it'd be great if you'd sometime give us a tour.
Mm-hmm.
And
off
we went.
It was just really informative. I mean, you wouldn't think, I think, going mm-hmm. to a cemetery, you're just like, oh, okay, this is a cemetery, whatever. Nope. There is a lot of history there.
Let's hear part of that.
When people go to a cemetery, they think it's pretty upfront how old it is, because you walk through and you say, you find a grave that says Madonna died in 1836, and you say the cemetery is that old. But that's not necessarily true, because a lot of people were moved here after they died, years after they died. In the 19th century, they moved people a lot. I don't know all the reasons they had to doing it, but one of the reasons in Fayetteville was that when Fayetteville started out, there wasn't any cemeteries, and people were buried in the backyard or the field behind the house, and as they people moved and streets were cut out and things, people wanted their loved ones to be in a more permanent place, thus Evergreen Cemetery.
Another misconception Bill explains is that Sophia Sawyer was the first person to be buried here. In 1870, the Masons bought land around Evergreen and began their own cemetery. When they did a recording of Evergreen to see who was buried here, the first grave recorded was Sophia's. And over time, some took that to mean she was the first person to be buried here. Though not the first, Sophia's grave is located in Evergreen, and Bill describes her as one of Fayetteville's pillars.
She was a really fiery woman. And she was pretty tough. And she, one of the stories that was told about her is that she was in Georgia, and she got in trouble for teaching a slave to read. And it was against the law to teach slaves to read. And they told her she was breaking the laws of the United States. And she kind of looked him in the eye and she said, I don't answer the laws of the United States. I answer the laws of a much higher and more civilized nation than the United States. I answer the laws of the Cherokee Nation, and your laws mean nothing to me. And then so she came around by boat when she moved, finally came, went to Oklahoma. It's kind of, she came all the way around Florida, down along the coast into the boat and up the Mississippi River and then up the Arkansas River till she couldn't come any farther. I don't know how far she got. And she did write that she was very concerned that the sailors used such foul language and that she didn't think it was becoming professional men like that to talk that way. So she was definitely a character.
Sophia also founded the Fayetteville Female Seminary in 1839. Etched on her tombstone are the words, "She had done what she could," which Bill notes is a phrase often found on women's graves in this part of the country. As we continue our stroll through the cemetery, from time to time I catch Bill glancing at notes he has written on little yellow pieces of paper for accuracy. However, it becomes clear rather quickly that he is a passionate storyteller who knows several of these tales by heart.
Some of this may be true or not true, but, you know, I think, as I say, these stories or these tales kind of point ways for researchers like Abby Burnett or people like that to go, and they find often a better story than what was originally told. This guy right here, see if I can read his name, James Troth, was killed on the square by a gun. He was upstairs on the square. And somebody was messing with a firearm down below, in the story below, and the bullet went through and killed him. So this is kind of an interesting little story. And if you see, when he died in 1870, it looks like. So that's a long time ago. But so you get these little stories of how people died, which is, it's kind of cool.
He was shot on the square.
Shot on the square by accident. Yeah. He was a pretty popular guy, and they had a big funeral for him.
Evergreen Cemetery is the resting place for several veterans. Bill says there are soldiers here who fought in every American war, except the Revolutionary War and the wars in the Gulf. He says more than 60 people who fought in the Civil War are buried here, and in fact, Evergreen Cemetery has more soldiers who fought in the Civil War than in World War II. One of the more well-known military men interred here is Lafayette Gregg.
This is Lafayette Gregg, and he has the tallest monument in the cemetery. He was on the Arkansas Supreme Court. he signed legislation to get the University of Arkansas here. And he was a unionist and supported the North in the Civil War. He was from the South, but he supported the North in the Civil War. So he had a price on his head by the Confederacy. And one of the stories is they caught him, and they were going to either shoot him or hang him the next morning. And it'd be like, people were really divided. It was about 50-50 here. And so some friends of his let him out in the middle of the night and gave him a horse and said, get out of here, they're going to kill you in the morning. So go, and he did.
In addition to those involved in military conflicts, Evergreen is the home to several other notable people.
In Evergreen Cemetery, we have one governor, six presidents of the University of Arkansas. We have a senator, which is J.W. Fulbright, who's probably the most famous person buried here. And we have five congressmen, a Hollywood producer, we'll walk by his grave, five colonels in the Civil War, one brigadier general, two baseball players, Sid Burton, if we may get to his grave, Sid Benton, he played for St. Louis in 1923, and his whole career was he pitched at two batters and walked both of them, and that was the end of his career. And then we have Roy Wood, who played for Cleveland and Pittsburgh, 1913 to 1915, and he had a pretty good record. He was a pretty good baseball player. He's buried right over there. We may get over to his grave. And
that's his family, you said, that was here?
Yeah, that was the woman right over there is his granddaughter. And which is just kind of apropos that she would just show up right now when we're talking about this.
As we continue exploring the cemetery for a while, we eventually circle back toward our car. After passing by a random patch of cacti, we find ourselves at the grave of an African-American who Bill says had to be snuck into the cemetery.
Adeline Blakely, 1850-1945, she was a slave. And she was given, very often there's a policy there, when a young woman got married, they would give her a slave to be her kind of a companion and take care of her for the rest of her life. You know, usually about the same age as she was. And that's what happened to her. She was given to a woman in the Blakely family. And she lived a long time. There's been other stuff written about her. You may know about more about her than I do. But anyway, I did talk to some of the members of the family, and they said when she died, she became like the matriarch of the family almost. She was like grandma. She raised all the kids and those kids, and they wanted her buried with them. And this was when you couldn't do that. This is when Jim Crow was still running the South. And so they snuck her in. And basically, they went to one of the funeral homes. I think it might have been Moore's, but I'm not sure which one it is. They basically said they wanted a closed coffin, and to tell, they knew the cemetery people. They bribed them not to say who she really was and put her down as an aunt and snuck her in. And they could have gotten big trouble for that, but of course they didn't, so she's here.
In 1915, the Masons deeded the cemetery to the Evergreen Cemetery Association. The group became incorporated as the Fayetteville Evergreen Cemetery Association in 1925, and it's been responsible for the care of the cemetery since. Today, Evergreen is overseen by a board, and although the cemetery seems pretty full, Bill says they bury about five people here annually. And just as a side note, you, Christina, had a story that was partially done at Evergreen Cemetery this year as well.
I did, yes. The 20th Century Women's Book Club celebrated its 100th anniversary, and the four founding members are all buried in Evergreen Cemetery. And so I went with a couple of members of that club and visited the graves of the founding women.
As long as we're with you, Christina.
Okay.
Not very far from Evergreen Cemetery at all is Waffle House.
It is. Just like a block and a half or so away.
You
this
went to Waffle House?
This
was
a fun interesting
story.
Cool. There.
Well, I started producing the Sunday show, I guess maybe in August or so, co-hosting with you, Kyle. And wanted to do something different and wasn't really sure what to do. And decided that there's a month or a week or a day for just about anything. I mean, there's a donut day. There's probably a Big Bird day. I don't know. I mean, there's a day for everything.
I hope so.
And so I started looking, at what was coming up. And there's a National Waffle Week. And I like Waffle House. So I thought it would be fun to go see what goes on in a Waffle House.
And what was interesting, you went, and it was right before football season kicked in. So they were really kind of like...
I think the first game, home game, was that weekend, yeah.
How'd the football season go, by the way? Anyway, yeah. But let's hear part of this from the Waffle House.
The coming week is National Waffle Week, and Waffle House will celebrate its 57th birthday. To kick off the festivities, I took a field trip to the Waffle House on Dixon Street in Fayetteville, where hash browns were sizzling on the flat top grill. Nick Williams is the division manager for the area. He oversees 7 stores in Missouri and 8 in Arkansas, this Dixon Street location being one of them.
This is an unusual circumstance because we're in the bottom story of a condominium on Dixon Street. And we had to work with the space that we were provided. And actually, after this store was built like this, there's been numerous stores across the country built close to campuses in situations like this. And this was kind of a learning experience for everybody. But, you know, I think we did pretty good with 28 seats squeezing in this little area, along with the rest of the kitchen and everything else that we need to operate.
Traditional Waffle Houses are freestanding, small buildings, and typically seat 33 to 43 people. The layout here is a bit different. The kitchen is wider than most, and rather than walking straight into the back room, grill operators and salespeople must hook a left to enter. The seating appears to be normal, the traditional booths and sit-up bar that customers are used to. But if you look to the walls, you'll find the decor is different. The tile trim lining the ceiling has character. 2 of them, actually. An Arkansas Razorback chasing, yep, a waffle with feet. This is also the logo that location employees wear on their uniforms, reminding customers that this is a college town and the University of Arkansas is right up the street. The Waffle House Company is very involved with local communities. Location manager Roy Odema says this spot in downtown Fayetteville is a prime place to do just that.
We like to do things with the university. We'll do discounts for the students and all that. We like to make it fun for them on game days. Sometimes we'll have Saturday nights. We'll have the president of the company out here playing bag-o at 1 o'clock in the morning. You know, it's something that's unique that a lot of other Waffle Houses don't necessarily get that opportunity. But it's a good community-wise. It fits what Waffle House stands for. You want to be involved, and we've done some other things that some charity work as well. But not necessarily for press, just because that's what Waffle House does. So.
He mentioned game days, and yesterday was the first game of the football season in Reynolds Razorback Stadium. As one can imagine, game days are often this location's busiest time, falling second only to Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue, where they see over a 30% increase in sales. On a given shift, the 29-seat restaurant will turn about 7 to 8 times. Manager Roy says that preparation is key.
We're excited about it. We try to staff up for those nights. Make sure we have extra hands. Also, another thing that's important is, we have to be very, a step ahead as far as the scheduling on Dixon Street, as far as what's going on the street. If there's a concert or something like that, we want to be prepared for those nights as well.
During busy shifts, it's all hands on deck, or grill. Roy mentioned earlier that the president of the company, who lives in Little Rock, is present on game day. But he isn't there just playing bag-o. He also cooks on the line. Another unique feature of the company as a whole, managers cook too. While I was there, one of the district managers donned a yellow and black striped hat, stepping in to help with the lunch shift, as Roy was busy talking with me. Atypical to this location are the times of day they see the most customers, as Nick Williams points out.
This store is unusual because the street, there's not much activity on the street during the day, but at night we just kind of blow up. 11 to 4, 11 to 5, we just get busy. And most of the other stores that actually have parking and have other businesses around them open in the morning, they all have a busy first shift as well in the morning.
They say that the best sellers also make this store unusual, the most ordered item being the cheeseburger. Kelly Thrasher with communications at the Waffle House headquarters in Norcross, Georgia, says that breakfast items are the most popular nationwide.
I think our actual best seller is actually coffee, and then waffles are absolutely up there.
They estimate that they sell 144 waffles per store per day.
So when you do that on a daily basis for each location, it totals about 85 million. So that's a lot of waffles.
Those sizzling hash browns are also very popular. Waffle House was started by 2 friends and neighbors, Joe Roger and Tom Fortner, who lived in Avondale Estates. Joe worked at Tottle House, a similar type restaurant. Tom thought they needed one in Avondale, opening the first Waffle House with the assistance of Joe's experience on Labor Day 1955, which was actually September 5th, not the 3rd. A few years later, when the Tottle House owner died, Joe came to work with Tom full-time. Waffle House pays homage to the restaurant that spawned their success on their menu.
Tottle House omelet, which is the kind of the way the omelet has been made, and I believe they made this way at the Tottle House. It's pretty much, the eggs are kind of fluffed, almost in like a whip, or like an, almost like a shaker, like a milkshake kind of whip thing. So it whips the eggs like a blender. So it whips the eggs, and they're really fluffy when they, so they pour them into the pan, and they never actually like stir them or anything, and just kind of roll them around in the pan and kind of flip them. So it's a really fluffy omelet.
Though well into their 90s, Joe and Tom make appearances at the office almost daily, ensuring that the traditions they began 57 years ago are maintained.
It was very important to Joe and Tom that this was going to be the service that they wanted to provide. And even though it seems like a vast menu, it's really a lot of staple items that we do. And our grill operators are just really good at what they do, and they make these things over and over and over. So it's really not complicated for them. And it's actually fairly easy for them to do this all day long.
Good food fast, that's the goal. Of the nearly 1,650 stores nationwide, primarily in the southern regions, 75% are company-owned, the remainder franchises. All bear the familiar yellow sign. I asked Kelly about the significance behind such a bright color.
The idea of the yellow and black sign had to do with school buses, because school buses were yellow and black, and they were always very easily like noticed, and you would always see them. So the idea of having those colors to kind of mimic school buses so that they were, you know, you could see them. They were like, you couldn't miss that yellow and black signage.
Unique to not just one location, but to Waffle House as a whole, are the terms used for ordering and the terms for those famous hash brown toppings.
It's not something that we actually came up with in the office. It's kind of like our grill operators in the restaurants came up with it themselves, you know, to help them kind of, you know, remember things. Because Scatter's Mother Covered didn't debut actually until, I believe it was 1984 when it hit the menu. So before that, it wasn't called in any other way. Grill operators made up those terms to, you know, as we started adding toppings to the hash browns, a way to remember the different items. And it just kind of, you know, continued as we added new items to come up with fun ways to call them in.
And every Waffle House, if you go to in the country, you'll hear scattered, smothered, covered, chunked, all that good stuff. And all that is it's a unique language that's found only in Waffle House. It's just the way that we call in tickets. It's the way that the grill operators know what to cook.
Now that we're back at the restaurant, a salesperson. The salespeople are what you might call a server in a different restaurant. But here, they are salespeople, because they do so much more than just serving. They drop waffles, run food, wash dishes. This salesperson is calling in an order.
Pull one sausage, one ham. Then typically I need to wait for her and make sure she does it. Drop two hash browns in the ring.
This is Ozarks at Large. We're talking about some of our favorite stories of the year. One of my favorites that you did, Jackie, was about Ozark dialect.
Oh, cool.
How it's kind of disappearing and yeah. The words and the phrasing.
Okay, so Kyle, where are you from?
I grew up in Baxter County, small town called Lakeview. So I grew up in rural Arkansas.
Katie?
I'm from Fayetteville.
Me too, Fayetteville.
Winslow, so right there.
I grew up in Rogers.
I'm from Chicago. Y'all don't sound like you're from the South. I don't know what up with that. And that's what got me onto this story. What is going on? Luckily, it turns out scholars say our language is not, you know, our dialects and our languages are not homogenizing. I had a fear about that, so I did a little research to prepare for this today. And so regional dialects are not declining. So exciting. So I thought I would get Susan Young in because she's native to Fayetteville. She says it's Fayetteville.
Fayetteville. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Correct. That's, she taught me how to say it. And she came in to talk about the Ozark. I called it Ozark English. I want to do a story in Ozark English. And so we got into it with her. And it was just so fun to talk with her. And we got so much great feedback to this piece. And by the way, Susan Young is outreach coordinator for the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History. And she will come talk to your group about this. If you are interested, you can contact the museum.
Buster Austin is an Ozark native. He turns 100 in October. And when we spoke with him early this summer for a story about homesteading in Madison County, he told us when he was a boy growing up, he loved to climb a rock bluff on nearby Penitentiary Mountain.
I've clumb it where it's nearly as tall as the trees.
I've clumb it. That archaic usage is rare and precious to linguists studying regional dialects. Shiloh Museum of Ozark History's Susan Young, a fifth-generation Ozarker, studies on these things. She travels widely as outreach coordinator, delivering programs of all kinds, including on Ozark dialect. But when she's out in public, she's also perennially on the lookout for native speakers.
When I can hear somebody say, and I don't hear it very often, why dinner was plum larpin'. All right, there are two things in there. Dinner was plum larpin'. Dinner being the noon meal. Dinner is the noon meal. Larpin is an old, old word for delicious.
Ozark English, she says, is mostly lost on Ozark urban districts. But in rural places?
People that live out in the rural areas that are living on the same land that they've lived on for generations, and grandpa and grandma might still live across the field from them, the traditions, including the dialect, just hangs on longer.
Especially in Newton County and Madison County, what some of the locals call Booger County.
There are two favorite words that I use in my Ozark dialect program for kids. One is booger. You know what a booger is? Oh, my gosh. Well, yeah, after they all come back from pretending to pick their nose, no, a booger is a ghost or a scary creature or a haint or a haunt.
Also, the double negative, which is schooled out of us.
There's not nobody that I can think of that knows these Ozarks any better than I do. I don't know. Not nobody. There ain't nobody. Yet double negatives are very, very common. And again, I don't know why. I can just tell you that when I hear it, oh, yeah, it's like, okay, my people.
And the ubiquitous y'all?
Now, I grew up with y'all, and I say that all the time. It's just a normal way of speaking, but the more I've listened and the more I've talked to people here in the Ozarks, yuns is more historically accurate. Yuns. Yuns better come and go with us. I hear people that still say that today. That's a real lovely sound to me because I don't hear a lot of people that say yuns. And when that's real Ozark right there, yuns.
Her accent, she says, exemplifies the broader Highland Plateau dialect, distinct from the Arkansas River Valley and Delta. So where is she from exactly?
Fedvul, F-E-D-V-U-L. Now, let me say that the last thing I want to do, most of the programs that I get called upon to do have to do with traditional Ozark folkways. It's what people love to hear about, and that can be building a log cabin, quilting, moonshining, and the Ozark dialect. So all those things, moonshining and the Ozark dialect especially, are just dripping with our stereotype. You know, this accent that I have, people immediately think you're kind of dumb, like you're a hillbilly. I mean, it's not just my cross to bear. That's part of the Ozark stereotype is the way we talk, or the Southern, the way we talk. Why? We must not have much book learning, or, you know, some of the wisest people I know sound like this.
But the thing is, Ozark English is rooted in Old English.
Travel writers and folklorists in the early 1900s especially made a big to-do about the Appalachians and the Ozarks having these remnants of an Anglo-Saxon seedbed, some of them would call it, and how you could go back in the hills of the Appalachians or in the Ozarks and find people talking the Elizabethan English, and that if you dropped William Shakespeare out of the sky and into this hill community, that he would be able to converse perfectly with the hill folk. And, well, that's a little over-romanticized because we didn't come from England and go straight to the Appalachians or the Ozarks. We had a chance to mix in on the East Coast with Germanic people and Scandinavian people. We had African Americans here with us as well. So it's not a perfectly intact Elizabethan English, but there are remnants of it, and there are a lot of scholars today that kind of poo-poo that and say that would say to me, "You're romanticizing this." But when I can pick out a word like salad that is in Shakespeare, Shakespeare used the word salad. I can have a green salad. Well, I grew up here, and we're going to hunt for poke salad.
Whilst reckon ain't and purchase to get a grip or purchase on something. All Anglo-Saxon. Pioneering folklorist John Lomax and his son Alan traveled the Mid and Deep South collecting songs, stories, and oral histories. But Susan says the rugged and remote Ozarks have been overlooked by such scholars. That's why the work of early to mid-20th century regional folklorists Vance Randolph, his spouse U of A English professor Mary Celestia Parler, and folklife writer Otto Ernest Rayburn is highly valued. Randolph, in particular, was keenly interested in the Ozark Highlands dialect, publishing a number of books which continue to sell to this day.
When Randolph was studying the Ozark folks, he purposely sought out the oldest members of a community that lived the furthest back in the hills because he wanted to get those remnants of the old ways. He didn't go to the Chamber of Commerce and talk to the Chamber of Commerce president in Springfield, Missouri. He went to the folks back in the hills and hollers. So I think he had a fair... Certainly his research is unparalleled as far as a regional focus on folkways of people. I also think, though, he knew how to sell books, and several of his books open up in the introduction with saying the Ozarks are the most deliberately unprogressive. The Ozark people are the most deliberately unprogressive people in the United States. And he knew that people had this, we had this yearning. We all have this yearning, I think, to go back to a simpler way of life, however you define that. And for so much of us, the American simpler way of life, historically, you think of the log cabin pioneers.
But it's Vance Randolph's spouse, Mary Celestia Parler, who's credited for being the most prolific Arkansas folklore researcher and recordist. Courtesy of the Mary Celestia Parler Collection at Special Collections at the U of A in Fayetteville, here's a 1951 recording of Mary High Briscoe, a rural Carroll County native herbalist and folk singer at the age of 76, talking about her grandpap being bewitched by 9 black cats.
And Grandma had gone to bed, and every night they'd come in and dance around. 9 black cats would come and dance around the floor. And it was just a new house. And so he fixed him a chinking to fit that hole that they'd come in at every night. Here they come in dancing around, and before he could get that chunk in to save his neck, every one of them had gone out.
Now note the difference between Mary Briscoe, who lived close to Missouri, and this tape of Ivy Trail, archived in the Library of Congress American Folklife Center, recorded by Vance Randolph in 1942 in Farmington. Ivy's reading a letter she'd written to President Theodore Roosevelt requesting more medical services for her people.
There's some that says people can't make a living in the hills and ought to move out, but our mountain people are happy and they can raise stuff to eat and they have lots of wood all around and plenty of pasture and they get along all right and they'd kill them to be cooped up in town and they don't ask no odds of nobody if it just wasn't for when sickness hits and things like that, why they can't get a doctor.
Other recordings of native Ozark English speakers reveal words like born, once, and twice, and a coming and a going. Again, Susan Young.
And I still hear that one quite a bit with the older folks in the rural areas.
What it does is it's almost a verb.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of... I don't know if it's an extra emphasis, not necessarily.
Linguists measuring cognate matrices, one word across cultures, for example, mom, have a new theory that Indo-European languages can be traced to Anatolian culture, that's present-day Turkey. But given our cultural amalgamation, they say, by the end of the 21st century, the world will have lost as many as 7,000 languages. So the next time you hear someone speaking Ozark English, you ought to sit and listen for a spell, says fifth-generation Ozarks native Susan Young.
When you go to visit, like you're going on a Sunday afternoon, you're having dinner, you're having a noon meal with your old relatives, you sit and visit, and you might stay there all day. And then when you're done, you say, well, we better go, and they'll say, well, you might as well stay a while longer. You might as well stay more. And then your response is, well, you might as well come. You better come go with us. It's a way of saying goodbye. The people that are leaving will say, well, you better come go with us, while the people that are staying will say, well, you better stay more. So it's just a way of saying goodbye, and that's a lovely, lovely Ozark tradition.
One thing we all worked on together this year was the first ever live show in front of a studio, in front of an audience. Mm-hmm. It was the Roots Festival across the street at the library. We're going to hear some music from that. And I just bring that up to ask, what would you we're the people who put together Ozarks at Large. Mm-hmm. And we've gone to daily over the last 2.5 years. We've had more musicians in. Now during the fundraiser, we're live so we can. And now we've done the Roots Festival. What would you like us to be able to do between now and the next time we get together? Do you have any thoughts? Do you have any things you'd like us to do?
For a live show?
Or for anything that you would like to hear more often on Ozarks at Large? Or this is your chance to kind of talk to the boss and say, boy, I wish we did more of that, or we wish we did less of that, or I wish you would write better. Wow, I've stumped him.
Yeah, deer in the headlights.
I tell you what, we'll play the music from Roots Festival. This is music from Steel Wheels. They opened the show, and that was so fun when that happened.
I had never heard of them before and love them now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There was a bit of anxiety in this building.
It was the great, mildly, great unknown.
It was, and... Okay, insight to a little bit about, because Antoinette produces a lot of shows with me.
Uh-huh.
Brian Hembry from Three Penny Acre. Brian and I have the same affliction in that we just come up with ideas left and right.
Yeah.
And if left alone, we should not be left without parental guidance, because we'll just start coming up with stuff.
No.
So Brian and I had a lunch, and this was 2 weeks before Roots Festival?
Maybe.
Maybe it was a week. I don't know. And he said, why don't we do a live show that day, that Friday, and kick it off with a live show at the library. I've got the room reserved. We'll just do it live. We'll have musicians. I've got these people. Grisman will be there. We'll do it live. And I just was on cloud nine. I came running into the building, and I went straight to Antoinette's office, and I said, we're going to do a live show for Roots Festival. You remember what you said?
I don't even know what I said. I just looked at you.
It was what you might call a buzzkill. It was like, oh. And then you came up with like 95 things. Well, have you thought about this? Have you done this? Have you done
right.
this? It did work out.
It went smooth. I think it went pretty
smoothly. It went smoothly, but I was trying to point out that you should think it through before you sign up for such things a week before. And also, you were not.
I think it was 2 weeks.
Maybe. But you were still a little concerned anyways, because their van literally rolled up and they piled out 5 minutes before we went on.
Because mm-hmm.
we were expecting them at half an hour before. And yeah, we had gone to plan B, C, and D by that point.
What I loved is the guys from Steel Wheels, they were up on the stage, and you know, it was quiet. It was like at a studio, because we were waiting for the cue.
Uh-huh.
I think, Timothy, you were over here,
yeah,
and you were
going
to say, go, because there is a 7 or 8 second delay in mm-hmm. broadcasting now. So we couldn't just monitor the radio. And it was real quiet, and everyone that was in the library was real quiet. And with about 30 seconds to go, the lead singer from Steel Wheels said, so you do this every Friday, these live shows?
Yeah.
I
said, I thought it was a thing.
I said, no, and he goes, well, how often do you do it? And I said, this will be the first.
Uh-huh.
And I think he kind of got a kick out of that.
I think he was excited about
yeah.
it.
Okay, well, let's listen to part of Steel Wheels. You guys think about what you'd like us to be able to do more of or start or something. Could you play one more song for us?
Why don't we?
Thank
yeah,
you.
We're
going to
do a little a cappella song for you here.
There's a rain coming down in the valley. We're gonna wash in the river so deep. Well, there's a rain coming down in the valley. Oh, Lord, there ain't no devil going where I go. Ain't no devil going where I go. Ain't no water gonna bring me down. There ain't no devil now. Gather up the rain coming. There's a rain coming down. Beat me out at the edge of town. There's a rain coming down. Tell everybody that the water's rising. There's a rain coming down. You tame, but it'll put you in the ground. There's a rain coming down. Well, there's a rain, coming down, in the valley. We're gonna wash in the river, so deep. Well, there's a rain, coming down, in the valley. Gonna bring me down. There ain't no devil now. I love all my children here. There's a rain coming down, like the roots that grow in the river for the tree. There's a rain coming down. If you get there before I do, there's a rain coming down. Tell what the water couldn't take from me. There's a rain, coming down, in the valley. We're gonna wash in the river, so deep. Well, there's a rain. There ain't no water gonna bring me down. There ain't no devil now.
Just some things. This is the last show of this week that we're talking about our favorite stories. First of all, I want to say Christina and Katie, you've been here now over a year. Thank you so much. I think you guys have really meshed well and...
Well, thank you back. I love working here.
I do too. Yeah, I can't imagine a better place.
Jackie, you and I have worked together how long now?
I don't know.
Okay, we'll just leave it at that.
Some frightening number.
Yes. Because I've been at KUAF now 23 and a half years, and you've been here...
All right, since 96.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. And you just kind of walked in one day, said, I'm going to do stories for you. I said, okay.
Yes.
Sounds all right.
Yeah. Timothy, you've been with us for a few months, and... And I think, and in case people don't know, the thing that we start most shows with, which we in-house call Segment A. Do we call it that on the web?
That's what I'm titling it as.
Because it's not quite a newscast of record, but it kind of updates you on stories that we don't have the time or energy to do full stories on, but we think you should know about. And you produce that, and it is beyond my wildest dreams what you've done with it. So thank you very much for that.
Yeah, you've
done great.
Also take care of the web. Mm-hmm. I mean, two things that we really appreciate, and I know our listeners appreciate.
And stands in and teaches me how to use my computer.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, a multi-talented fellow here that can't leave. And I want to thank Antoinette for being kind of the person who talks reason to me. And
that's a nicer way of saying Buzzkill.
Yes. But often I'll have ideas... Or, not often. I always
you all,
have.
Yeah.
And Antoinette is the person who is most likely to say, now think about this. Mm-hmm. Can we do this? Can you really commit to being at work for all that time? And often you succeed.
I try.
Yes.
And she asks you if you've eaten lunch.
She doesn't even ask any. Well, yeah, she asks and then forces me out to go eat lunch, and I appreciate that. You all take care of me, and I do appreciate that. I cannot imagine a better place to work. Now, having said that, and Timothy, having said how well you've done, and I don't want this to make you feel uneasy, but we did say goodbye to Ithi Agnihotri-Madulkar this year. That's who you kind of replaced. Right. And so when we sometimes talk about Ithi and how we miss her, that doesn't mean we don't like having you here.
Oh, no, I completely understand that. But, I mean, I don't even see my role here as filling in for Ithi, because how do you replace someone?
Yeah, well, exactly. And we do miss her. Right? Mm-hmm. This year she said goodbye after she had done this wonderful series, this 6-part, 5-day series on poverty that she had wanted to do and spent months getting it ready. But as she left, an exit interview, and this is just a little bit of what she said about leaving.
There's something I want to say, which I think would pretty much sum what
But this means this time, this, you know, this moment. This is a quote from Reading Lolita in Tehran. This was written by an Iranian author called Azar Nafisi. And this really sums up what I'm feeling right now. You get a strange feeling when you're about to leave a place. Like you'll not only miss the people you love, but you'll also miss the person you are now, at this time, and this place. Because you'll never be this way ever again.
Best of luck to you and Mahir in Arizona. I don't know if you can right now. But it would be great if you could just say one more time for Ozarks at Large.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Iti Agnihotri Mudolkar.
We miss her. Now, let's get back to what I'd asked earlier about what would you like, if you, not personal resolutions for 2013, but if you had professional, if, as a show, is there anything you'd like the show to do?
Yes.
I knew you'd have something.
I want to go to various towns as a group and produce the show from that town.
Mm-hmm. I was actually going to say, I want to do more things together.
Yes.
So if you're listening and you're in a town and you want us to come, Clarksville. I've had someone from Clarksville say, you should do an entire show from Clarksville. Maybe we'll go there.
Oh, good.
But send us your ideas. Any others?
I want to do all the things that I said I was going to do this year that I didn't do.
So a Christmas show?
Yeah, I really want to do a Christmas show.
That's kind of a merging of your ideas here. Antoinette would like to have, you know, a local musician, two or three.
But like doing it on stage where people could actually come and see it. And it wouldn't be on Christmas, but we could air it later on Christmas or something like that.
Yeah. We could record it in late November or something. Okay, I like that. These are very ambitious goals. Christina, do you have
one? Doing more things together, you know. I mean, it's nice to sit here and talk, but and then also we talked about doing a series, but you know, going into local restaurants, but going together, you know. And I think it would be good to, you know, do things like that. I mean, I know we're a small staff and it's hard to get two people out of the studio at the same time, but you know, it would be nice. I know you and Antoinette sometimes do stuff together, but if we could, you know, all kind of
I would
try
love to do
that.
Yeah. Timothy, do you have any ideas?
You know, the Roots Festival was really fun. I liked it because it was, you know, mostly a music show. There was a little bit of other stuff in there, but it was live music and you talked to the artists. I think we should do more of that, just more live music and information shows.
I like that. Katie?
My answer's not as heartwarming, but...
That's okay.
I think it would be fun to do more with visual, video, and stuff like that.
Yes, absolutely. It would add
another layer to what we already do with Ozarks. So.
Guess who's going to be taking filmmaking courses?
You?
Sophia.
Ah, mm-hmm. Okay, we got to keep her here then, too. And we should say thanks to John Schlois, Sophie Kidd, who did some stories for us this year as well. And thank them very much. I would like to do... One of my big fears is that I don't want the show to ever become boring for listeners. So shake it up a little bit. I'd like us to do some thematic shows, but I also like to do one where we walk in on a Monday morning and we have a hat full of subjects. We've all written like 10 or 15 down on slips of paper. We put them in a hat. We draw them out. We each get one. And then by Thursday, we've had to put that show together based on that one or two words that we picked out.
Oh, wow.
I think it'd be fun. It could be an unmitigated disaster.
But totally could.
But that could be fun. Not the disaster part, but just the...
Disasters can be fun.
Disasters can be fun. thanks for sitting in and doing this again this year. I hope we're all back here at this table again next year and can talk more. And we'll talk about all those shows we've done live and in different towns. And we love ideas, so send us ideas. Ozarksatlarge.com or ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. And thank y'all.
Thank you.
Thank you.